This podcast is part of the London Business School series, Inside the Global Economy, in which leading experts explore what is really going on in the global economy today.
Hello, all. I'm Richard Portis, Professor of Economics at London Business School, and I welcome you to a series of podcasts in which we discuss how financial services are changing in a world of ultra-low interest rates, rising competition, and continued regulatory pressures. It's part of Inside the Global Economy. I'm here with Michael Mendelson, a principal and member of the executive committee of AQR, a firm with a very substantial amount of money under management, which follows what are called quantitative strategies for the most part. And we are going to discuss a number of questions relating more broadly to asset management here at the headquarters of AQR in Greenwich, Connecticut. So, Michael, let's start with a broad question about the environment, as it were. Compared to other parts of the financial system, the asset management industry, as it were, is relatively young. It now invests a huge proportion of the world's wealth. Estimates are $100 trillion or even more. How is that evolving? How is the industry evolving to best manage the risks that are involved?
Well, Richard, that is right. It is an awful lot of money and an awful lot of responsibility for an industry that is pretty new. You don't have to go back too many decades to find a much smaller world of investment and handled maybe by bank trust departments, insurance companies, and then this whole asset management business grew. And I think people thought of it as an easy business to get into. It was, you know, two guys in a Bloomberg and a phone could start a hedge fund and just invest in it. But things happen in markets, and people realized over time that they had to start managing risk, investment risk, market risk. And I would say the earlier formal efforts to do that really, I probably would really surprise you, but it really didn't start much before 10 years ago. Bank risk management departments are now 25 years old, a little older than that, but that's all. I mean, that's surprising in and of itself. Asset management world, it's probably a decade. You know, over that time, I think we've learned that you've got to do a bunch of different things. Obviously, the market risk part is the one that's on everybody's mind, but it's hardly enough. You learn from bad things happening, sometimes to yourself. That's what I would call the hard way. And sometimes you learn the easy way when something bad happens to somebody else. It's not easy for them, but at least they paid the tuition and you get the education. We started an effort on counterparty risk management back at the end of 2006 because we had suffered a small counterparty loss. It seemed a little embarrassing at the time. It was on some swaps on cattle futures trades, and the counterparty broker failed very quickly. So we hired a counterparty credit risk manager who remains with the firm today and has developed a really good effort on this. It helped us a lot in 2008 when the world had really serious counterparty efforts. So you can sometimes learn that way, and then sometimes you grow up the other way where the regulators come to you and say, hey, we see the banks getting attacked all the time by cyber threats. And your industry, your asset management industry, you got to start paying attention to this. And so we did, and so did the rest of our industry, and they were right. So our industry as a whole has developed capabilities for managing its risk beyond just the market, operational risks, model risk management, things that are really important but are surprisingly new, I would say. I think most people who are maybe a little younger than us, Richard, are probably see this as an industry that's been around forever, but it's not. And these efforts are really still, I would say, and I think we'll look back at them years from now as being in the earlier stages rather than the later stages of development.
How do you deal with unknown unknowns?
Yeah.
Take a recent event. You have a bombing of Saudi oil production facilities, which has huge ramifications potentially. Comes in a sense out of the air in more than one sense. And how do you handle that kind of event as a risk manager?
Risk management has to be able to anticipate that there's going to be crazy things that happen in the world. The event in Saudi Arabia was certainly had a pretty major impact on oil prices, maybe a little more muted than you might have guessed on some other markets like the stock market, but still that was a big event. And certainly you can have much bigger events than that. You can have a huge earthquake. You can have all kinds of stuff happen. And you have to understand that your portfolios are going to be exposed to risks that you cannot identify easily in advance, but you have to try to at least make them resilient to them.
Is it harder for a quant firm to do that than a...
It might be easier. I think of ourselves as, you know, the new world for quant is systematic. So we do things systematically. And that includes daily evaluation of portfolios based on potential events that can happen. We can't get all the potential events, but we can do things like, and what I'm sure many managers do, how exposed are your portfolios to oil price shock risks. You never quite really get those exposures exactly what you think because you don't know what the other asset classes do. You can only kind of guess at what they might do. But you can evaluate those, and you can systematically evaluate those and try to make sure that your portfolios are not overly exposed. You don't make them neutral to those events. Okay, you can't make them neutral to every event. But you do try to limit the exposure to those, and you may have even risk limits on how much at least the potential exposure is to those.
Let me turn to a more technical question about leverage. Does AQR employ leverage in any significant way?
Well, we are a levered fund manager. We're also an unlevered fund manager. I would say that of our assets under management, about half of those are in unlevered strategies, and about half are in levered strategies. So that makes us certainly one of the largest levered fund managers in the world. Our clients as a whole, which are mostly institutional investors, are generally unlevered or very low leverage. I would say in our funds, we employ leverage in a variety of different ways. We trade futures, which are implicitly leveraged, so swaps, FX forwards, all implicitly levered. And then we also trade equity positions, usually market neutral equity positions, where they're financed also. So we have to deal with leverage. We think that modest leverage and well-managed leverage is important for investors to get diversification. And I think that there's a lot of aspects of thinking about leverage, of course, but one of the most interesting things is why do people use leverage? I think the kind of man on the street view of why you use leverage is to take something risky and to make it riskier. Buy stocks, lever them 5-1, and then you've got something really crazy. You can make a lot of money or you could go broke. It's actually not how people use leverage. Leverage is really used for the most part to take things that are not risky enough and make them risky enough so that they have a place they can consume capital in your portfolio. And it's using leverage that is really the enabler of real risk diversification in a portfolio. And, you know, you can look at it as investors have a choice between being concentrated in risk or being diversified, but to be diversified, you need to use leverage. And why is that? It's mainly because most investors need to take a pretty fair amount of risk. Let's take a U.S. pension fund or a U.K. pension fund for that matter. Usually you need to have a portfolio risk that, let's say, is on the order of 10% per year. It doesn't matter if it's 8 or 12 or whatever. You have a couple ways of getting there. One way is to buy a lot of stock, which is mainly the way that you get there. Okay. But that necessarily leads you to a portfolio that is concentrated in equity market risk, like sort of the canonical 60-40 portfolio in the U.S., maybe more like 50-50 in the U.K., is almost all equity risk. The bonds almost don't matter. They're more like ballast, I think of them, in the portfolio. But I need to take that much risk because I need to earn a lot of returns, right? I mean, I can't have a portfolio that's 4% risk and earns me 1.5% over cash a year that doesn't pay my pension beneficiaries. So I need to take a lot of risk. I either get a lot of equity risk or I need to have a lot of risk in other stuff. And the only way to get that, to get enough risk of other things, is since everything else has less risk mostly than equities, let's take bonds for example, is I need to use some leverage. I need to apply leverage to bonds or I need to apply leverage to other asset classes or other types of diversifying strategies that don't have equity market exposure. And since those things have less risk, they need leverage. And that's sort of your basic trade. You either are going to use leverage or you're going to get concentrated. Neither is perfect, okay? And how does somebody who is a big believer in diversification like myself and a lot of other people think of it? You should have some of each.
It's interesting that if you look at the data in a number of derivative markets, we used to think that banks were the ones levered highly and that's how they got into trouble and so on and so forth. Now, if you look at the numbers, it's the asset managers and in particular pension funds and insurance companies that are the major holders, at least in Europe, of derivatives portfolios. And do you think that is going a bit too far?
I think that the reason that they're the biggest holders is because they're in aggregate so big. If you look at U.S. investors, for example, and it's no different in Europe, the institutional money, let's say your typical, you know, your large pension fund, has derivatives exposures. And in aggregate, it's going to end up being a lot of dollars because they're big. But their total leverage is very low. And so it's sort of in strong hands. Their leverage does create certain risks. One indicator of how much risk that is how levered are you, obviously. And I think in our world, the good news is that people are not very levered.
Michael, suppose that there were a run on an asset manager holding a lot of long-dated or illiquid assets in the portfolios of their clients. Would it be appropriate, do you think, in those circumstances to impose redemption gates? We've seen some of this very recently.
We're mainly a manager of very liquid strategies, so it's not a big direct issue for us. But to impose redemption gates, first, the documents have to allow for it. So investors have to knowingly realize or understand that they're and sign on for funds that may do that. There's a couple ways that people can't get their money out when they want to. One would be when a manager has to suspend valuations or redemptions because of an extraordinary event. And most funds have documentation that allows this. So, for example, it might be a natural catastrophe that creates a market close for a couple of days. You can't value your portfolio, so you can't redeem investors. And then once that event normalizes, then things go back to normal.
With the Brexit referendum, unexpected result in the UK the day after, a number of commercial real estate open-ended funds had to close the doors.
Right. And that's sort of a little bit of a strange circumstance because it's not quite the natural catastrophe. Markets were open. On the other hand, it's not quite like a gate either, right? What's the purpose of a gate? A gate is something where you anticipate a large volume of redemptions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be today. It could be over a month, 2 months, 3 months, whatever. And where you're really looking to be able to liquidate your portfolio or a big chunk of it in an orderly way that is fair for all investors in a multi-investor fund. And that's sort of the essential trade-off. People want to be able to get their money back when they redeem, you know, and there's obviously rules and time periods for redemptions, but you want to treat everybody fairly. And so if the documents allow the manager to determine that the fairest way to treat investors is to gate them and let them kind of go out in an orderly way, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. It's not a device for a manager to retain assets under management. That is not the purpose. It should not be the purpose of doing that. And it turns out that I think there were some funds that did that back in 2008. Investors hated being gated. Okay, they really hated it. But I'm sure that there were funds for which that was the thing that was in the best interest of the shareholders of those funds, meaning that the broad range of investors that wanted to redeem and to be able to do it without sort of having huge price impact of selling things. So there are appropriate circumstances for doing it. That doesn't mean that if a manager has it in its documentation that somehow that could not be inappropriately used. That's always a possibility. I'm not familiar with those situations, but I would guess it's probably happened at some point.
As a footnote, Barbara Novick of BlackRock maintains that having talked with a number of investors in those real estate funds that I was mentioning before, 6 months later, they say, no, it was fine. We understood. We weren't too disturbed. And, of course, the gates were lifted, and there was no rush out.
That's interesting. So the idea then that managers just assumed there was going to be a tidal wave of redemptions that never happened, and those real estate funds are very illiquid.
They may have tried to. I mean, there might have been a tidal wave, and there was certainly initially a push, and they said, you know, we can't liquidate those investments without huge losses, and so let's just shut the gates and see how things calm down.
Right. Oh, I know this is something that you've worked on yourself, but there are strategies out there that give investors exposure to illiquid assets. And they're in vehicles that are multi-investors, so they need to have some way, or at least in some packages, you have some way for investors getting money back on demand. Now, that obviously doesn't happen in things like private equity and other cases. And when an investor is in that structure, they have to understand that that can happen. And that is, you know, so there might be circumstances under which they might be adversely affected. And what we need to look at in those cases is, what kind of investor money is that? If it's investor money that is in some risk-taking pool where there's no need for liquidity on the investor's part, that can be fine. Where I think sometimes funds get run into trouble is where the investors themselves see those assets as perfectly liquid and, let's say, no risk. And obviously the most prominent example of that might be something like a cash fund. And my particular issue with things sometimes is when you present something as essentially a fiction, where you have assets that are volatile, but you're marking them as not volatile. Where people have capital that they think is liquid and safe, then the underlying investments, I think, probably also need to reflect that, or they need to be accounted for differently.
Let's turn to regulation issues.
Sure.
Some asset managers would argue that since asset managers really don't have any balance sheets, it's the clients who are taking the risk, not the asset managers, and therefore there's no justification for regulation. You can't be at the origin of systemic risk. Do you see any areas where regulatory intervention in asset management is justified? For example, limits on leverage, to go back a bit.
You know, the whole notion of trying to have regulatory oversight of systemic risks came out of the financial crisis. And obviously the first place that was examined were banks, and I think appropriately so, because I think it ultimately, for the economy's sake at least, it is ultimately all about the banks. It's like you have a healthy banking system, you're okay. You don't really want to subject that banking system to a lot of risk. So first they looked at the banking system, fine. After that was kind of, I wouldn't call it settled business because it's not settled business, but at least it was on the road to that. Regulators turned to the asset management industry. And I think at first looked at it like it's a financial institution, like a bank, and said, okay, let's figure out how to create capital requirements and other things for the asset management company. But it's a different structure of the industry. And although our industry has risks and they need to be examined, it's a legitimate question, it isn't particularly interesting looking at the asset management companies themselves. What we care about is the funds and the assets. The asset management companies don't trade. When an asset manager fails, it doesn't necessarily move the portfolio or create any risk for an investor. Investors just ultimately pull their assets. So there's sort of a separation of those two things, the leverage, the risk, the way that the industry affects the banking system is through the portfolios, not through the management company.
Let's take a couple of examples historically. LTCM, where the problem was very complex. Lehman itself, which wasn't a bank, really.
It traded as principal for its own account.
Exactly. And AIG, an insurance company that happened to get into the business of selling a lot of CDS contracts and became systemically important in that way.
Two of those cases are AIG and Lehman, are places where a capitalized institution traded for its own account, and the institution itself was what counterparties were exposed to. In the case of LTCM, which took place, you can see it actually out our window here, about a quarter of a mile away, back in 1998, LTCM had a fund that was very highly levered, sort of extraordinary leverage, and I believe there's nothing that approaches anywhere near that for many years now.
Not even Deutsche Bank?
Well, again, Deutsche Bank is a fund, and even Deutsche Bank has not been as levered as LTCM was in the summer of 1998. That fund ran into trouble, obviously. The fund management company continued to function, and the people who own that fund management company, I think, kind of faded away, but various banks sent people, including a friend of mine, over to run that place for quite a long time to wind it down. The management company, you know, the office space that they were in and the work they were doing, that continued on. The fact that the management company continued to pay its bills and didn't fail didn't really help the financial markets at all. What mattered was that fund. That's the entity that matters.
So we should see the regulators looking very closely at the funds.
Yes.
Themselves.
Yeah. So the first thing I think that happened in you know the regulatory push for looking at asset management is people realized, oh, it's not the management companies, it's the funds. Okay. So I think that's sort of generally agreed on at this point. So what are the things that people care about with funds? Well, there's sort of we've already mentioned maybe the two major things, which are examine leverage, because leverage affects the banking system, right? And the other one's liquidity, okay? And liquidity, you know, for example, when we're discussing about Gates, you know, liquidity affects the investors, and that might have some knock-on effect depending on what the investors hold those assets for. So leverage, I think, is probably the one, though, that's created the most attention. And I think what's ultimately going to be found is that the asset management industry doesn't have enormous amounts of leverage. It has a lot in total dollars, but it's not a super levered fund. And in fact, if you look at the levered investors, the levered fund managers like ourselves, you know, we generally manage pretty moderate leverage funds. And why is that? There's a really important underlying reason. And that is because there's no market for really risky funds. That's not what institutions want. If you're managing low-risk assets like bonds and you need to generate a moderate level of risk, okay, then you need to apply some leverage, but only some. So, for example, institutional portfolios, let's say they kind of average around 10% annualized volatility. If they're interested in leverage strategies, tends to be strategies in about that risk level. If, let's say, stocks are, on average, 15, 16% annual volatility, then you don't have to really apply leverage to get to 10%. If bonds, maybe 4% annualized volatility, well, then you need a certain amount of leverage to get there. But first of all, it doesn't make the portfolio particularly levered. The other thing is that it's not a whole lot of leverage. What there isn't much of a market for, at least not to our awareness, is portfolios that are 50 or 100% annualized volatility. Not to say no one's ever tried that. Okay. So people have done that, but it's a rarity. And we can think about, we know what those funds are because that's not really where the market is. And so what I think is going to end up being found, and why I say I'm speaking in the future, and I'll get to why that is in a second, is that their funds are not really horribly leveraged. They're very modestly leveraged. Why do I say in the future? I say in the future because they first have to measure this from a regulatory perspective. Obviously, we measure this and our competitors measure this, but the regulators are struggling to figure out how they want to have it reported and measured to them. Okay? And there's been a project going on now for a couple of years from IOSCO, which is the sort of international body of national regulators, of securities regulators, trying to figure out how they just want to define leverage. And I'm a little worried about it. I mean, I think IOSCO's come out with a report that's good, but they're not ultimately the final say on
it. It's very, very complex and difficult. And there are just so many different possible ways to approach this. I sit on the European Systemic Risk Board, which is the macroprudential authority of the European Union. And I chair the Committee on Non-Bank Financial Intermediation. And we have spent hours talking about different possible definitions of leverage in funds and so forth. And you really do find that you have to have tailored definitions for different circumstances, and getting any kind of aggregate measure, it may not be possible.
Well, so here's my suggestion to you, is that there is some school of thought out there that wants what they consider the simplest measure. And I'm going to contend that it is the second simplest measure. It's also a useless measure. And that is the aggregate total gross notional exposure. And it's useless because if I add up how much stocks and how much bonds I have, it already destroys the information. It is a, as I've said before, is a useless sum of useful parts. What is the simplest measure? Well, let me step back a second. If I had a levered portfolio from an asset manager that had, and now I'm going to speak in terms of percentage of the asset value of the NAV of the fund, if it was 100% stocks and 200% bonds, so it, let's say it held some stock futures and some bond futures, so easy to put that position on, that position would be fairly risky because I've got 100% stocks. That's already most of the risk, and adding 200% bonds adds a little bit of risk. I might say that that's got total gross notional of 300%. 300% of just stocks would be really risky. 300% of treasury bills would be trivial risk. So it really matters what's there. Well, in order to come up with a total gross notional, the alleged simplest way of doing this, 300%, I have to calculate, sum up all my stocks, which is 100%. I have to sum up all my bonds, which is 200%. And then I have to add them together. And what I'm claiming would be useful for regulatory purposes is do exactly the same thing, just don't add the two numbers together. Meaning that what should be reported is a fund manager. I tell you I've got 100% stocks and 200% bonds. Now you've got useful information because you kind of know how risky 100% long stocks is. You kind of know how risky 200%, you know, 10-year bonds is, let's say. And I can now add that up across entities. I can't do that as a manager. I can't add across, you know, ourselves and other firms. But as a regulator could take all the equity exposures, all the long exposures, all the short exposures, add them across firms, could take all the bond exposures and do that. But once I mix them up at the manager level and we report a total aggregate, we lose all the interesting information. Yeah. And it's not more complicated because it actually is one less sum. And so we've been recommending that, I think, you know, for a couple years now. I think that IOSCO has also come up with at least their initial report seems to be in favor of that approach, which we like. And I'm hoping that we'll adopt that as a way of doing it. It's funny. It's like you want to have the simple gross notional actually has some interesting information, as long as I don't add up across apples and oranges.
One of the big, shifting gears a bit, one of the big trends in the past decade or even more maybe, is the move into passive investment, into trackers, into ETFs to some extent. And how does that affect a firm like AQR, which is quite the opposite? Is the competition, in a sense, just a matter of lower fees, or how do you see this?
Well, the first thing we think about is how does it affect market efficiency? And the answer is we don't know how it affects market efficiency. I would love to know.
But how do you feel about it as competition, in a sense?
I think if you're an active manager, a traditional active manager, who, you know, is like a stock picker or a bond picker, it's bad, okay? But if you're a systematic manager like us, it's murkier. Partly it's a fee thing. Partly it's a market efficiency thing. As you've seen money move from the traditional active to passive, it's not obvious that some of that money hasn't also moved to, you know, factor-based investing, things that we do, things that systematic managers do, that we do at a fair fee, and that in the move towards generally having institutions reduce their fee load, some of that money may have also come our way.
We're running low on time, so I'm going to shift to a couple of, in a sense, social issues. One is the one that you read about every day, and that is ESG, environment, social, governance. How does the ESG story affect the portfolio choices, in fact, of asset managers today? And do you at AQR, is it something that you take into account in your own investment decisions?
Well, I think for a good while now, part of that is definitely been in portfolios, definitely been in our portfolios, and I think not just ours, and that is the governance part. I think people who've studied governance, people have seen over the last couple decades that good governance helps portfolio performance, or at least focusing on good governance helps portfolio performance. And so that has been a feature of portfolios, I think, for quite a number of years. There's obviously now more interest in that, but that's not really a new part of it. What's, I think, been more relevant today, or more social interest today, is that some investments just don't fit the values of the investors. And so the obvious answer has been, and this is also not necessarily that new, although it's growing, is just not to own them. I think as this body of work has developed, people have realized it's not the only way to align an investor portfolio with the organizational values. And people are working on that. Along with the UNPRI, we wrote a short white paper, a very simple one. It doesn't take very long to read, called Clearing the Air, not too long ago, where we described a framework for responsible investing. And it discusses both asset selection. An example of that being what we just said, is that if industry doesn't align with your values, don't own it. And also, I think an area that's really growing in interest to people, which is methods people use to exercise their ownership rights post-security selection. So we set out like a framework for thinking about it, but some of the really interesting things are how people vary in implementation. You know, it's like one way you could look at not investing in particular industries is that it raises the cost of capital for those industries. It might not have a lot of impact on a particular performance of the investor who's got many industries they're exposed to, but it may matter to that industry, may raise the cost of capital, may make it more difficult for them to do business, and in effect probably slows the growth of that industry, which may be the goal of the investor. On the other hand, as people are now more focused on post asset purchase, exercise of your ownership rights. Certainly, an investor approaches it that way, sort of doesn't have influence beyond that, can raise the cost of capital for an industry, but can't really influence it much beyond that. What we've seen, and I would say this is certainly the minority of it, though, is investors who say, I'm going to just invest more in that industry, because now what I'm going to do is I'm going to now pull the levers I have available to me as an owner in ownership and try to set that business on a different path that's better aligned with my values. So it's sort of, you've got these completely different choices pre-asset selection because there are different intents post-asset selection. And I think that's kind of a new thing, but one that's now going on. One other thing that is also becoming very common is on the manager side, is managers focusing on the risk. We're always focusing on the risks of different portfolios and different securities, but now incorporating things that people thought were non-financial, okay, but can end up, and I think people are coming to the realization, this can end up becoming very financial. And that is the risks of cultural shifts and regulatory shifts and political shifts that may have really big impact on the value of businesses. And so is that ESG investing? Is that risk management? It really can be exactly the same thing.
Let me finish with a question directed, in a sense, towards London Business School interests. I've been at London Business School myself for 24 years now and seen generations of students pass through. And AQR has partnered with London Business School with generous financing to create the AQR Asset Management Institute, of which I'm an academic co-director, and that supports not only research, but also, in various ways, activities that are relevant to our students, and PhD students in particular. And I think about the asset management sector and young people's choices when they think about careers. Do you think that now, I mean, you got in early, in a sense, okay.
Well, got it early. That's a statement about our age.
Right? You got in early, and it was all very exciting and so on and so on.
Yep.
And is it less exciting now? Are the opportunities for careers less potentially rewarding for young people now than they were, say, 10, 15 years ago? What should younger people be looking for in an asset management firm if they do decide that they want to work in that sector?
I think it's still a great place to be. There's still a lot of exciting things happening. people in the industry do important things. At least we think they're important things. Certainly, as you pointed out earlier on, we manage, you know, the industry manages an awful lot of money, and that does matter. And I think an awful lot of it is the retirement security of probably now billions of people around the world. It's a pretty meaningful thing. And it's an industry that attracts a lot of smart people. It's pretty dynamic. It changes all the time, and people need to be willing to change all the time. I've done several different things over the past few decades in this business, and I think anybody who's been in it for a long time has done a bunch of different things. I would have never guessed how my career would have evolved, which is probably a good thing. I guess overall, I think if you're interested in working with smart people and not being able to predict where you're going till your retirement, it's really a great place to be. Certainly, you can look at our industry as a place where you build human capital, and then over the decades, convert human capital to financial capital that you can retire on, hopefully. And so as a young person, I think the most important thing is thinking about how do you build your human capital. There's sort of a bargain you make with your employer. You're doing work for them, but you got to learn something. And it's not like you're not just working for that paycheck. You're working for the PV of it. And how do you build that PV? You've got to collect your pay so you can pay your rent, but you've also got to develop your capital by being trained, by working with people who are smart, by working in an organization. And good news is most asset management businesses are like this, that are flat enough so that you have access to senior people and to big things that are happening at those firms. That gives you some internal mobility opportunity, because you don't want to be just doing the same thing forever. That's never going to work. That's never what a long-term career in our business is about. And then you want to be working in a place that has a real commitment to training you, not only when you first walk in the door so that you can do your job, but so that you really understand the industry, that you understand the science behind it. And obviously, school's a great place to start and an essential place to start, but it doesn't end there. It's one of the reasons why our firm has had pretty strong academic ties for a long time. We think it's really important for the development of all of our people, including the senior people. But I think that's really the way I would think about it. If I were able to be a third of my age and starting over, I would really want to focus very hard on being in an environment where I could build my human capital while I was paying my rent.
I think we'll have to end there. And I think those of you out there who have followed this podcast will realize that AQR has some very smart people, and that Michael Mendelsohn is a pretty good example of that. We've covered a number of topics. There were others we could have talked about, but I think the time constraint is binding. All that remains for me to do is to thank you very much, Michael.
Well, thank you, Richard. I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Sharing your experience and your wisdom, and those who've been listening will have learned a lot.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, and thank you very much.
This was a London Business School podcast, bringing you fresh insights and ideas from London Business School's experts. To listen and read more, visit www.london.edu.